watch says 6:16:37,
which means it's 6:15 and it's time to start. We are going to cover four things in today's session. One is an introduction. That's what we're doing now. Two is we're going to talk about geologic time. Three, we're going to talk about plate tectonics. And four, we are going to answer the question, how did the Holden Mine get here? That here is in capital letters. The point being, why are we here rather than at the Holden Mine in Nebraska, or the Holden Mine in Florida, or the Holden Mine some other place? We're here for a reason. Nancy and Jim are the ones who are focusing on why we're, what that reason is why we're here in the metaphysical sense. I'm talking about a very pedestrian sense of why we're here. We are here because Holden Village is here. Holden Village is here because the Holden Mine was here. This was the miners' village when the mine was going. The Holden Mine is here because J.H. Holden did prospecting along the shoreline of Lake Chelan and one day wandered up the Railroad Creek Valley, and rumor has it he was out shooting quail one night for dinner and he shot a bird up on the slope here, and the bird fell onto some red rock and he said, that looks like ore. That ore is there because of a geologic story that goes back, I'm going to tell you, perhaps 250 million years. So as we talk about the concept, the theme of time and treasure, when I heard that was going to be the theme for this, I got to thinking about, there are two very different stories here. One is the geologic scale time, which goes back 250 million years, and the other, the human scale story that goes back to 1883 or 1887, something like that. It's in a book that's going to go with the slideshow that I'm going to show you tomorrow. But since that's tomorrow, I'm not that up on it yet. But I will be tomorrow. So, as part of the introduction, my name is Don Coberly. My business card right here says I'm a senior hydrogeologist. Of all the times, that seems funny to me, being at Holden Elder Village. It seems funnier than most times. What that means is that I've been studying hydrogeology, which is groundwater, for a long time, 20 years now. And I came to Holden in 1997 for the first time to study the mine site. And I have been working here off and on ever since with a lot of on, and have been fortunate enough to, at one point quite a while ago, have been invited to be on the volunteer teaching staff during the summer, and then from there got the opportunity to teach Elder Hostel and now Holden Elder Village. I think this is the seventh time I've done this. So, and it is, I have a ball. I really hope you will too. I guess what I would like to get done here is for me to have fun, for you to have fun, and for you to learn some geology. And I'm not sure what order I would put those in, but certainly the learning geology would be third. So what else did I want to tell you about? Oh, the schedule. Today we're going to have this talk, and it's going to be the stuff we just talked about, and it's going to be on the geologic time scale of things. Tomorrow we're going to talk about Holden and his influence and why we're here. What is the human scale story that gets us to be here, which is Holden starting in the 1880s, running up until 1938, which was the first time they sent a load of ore down or concentrate down the hill to go to Tacoma to be smelted. On Wednesday, we'll take a hike. For those of you who were here last year, we'll be covering the same ground, but we'll be talking about some different things. That stuff I told you last year was pretty much all made up, but now I know what I'm talking about. So it'll be better. The focus will be, again, for these first 3 days, what I'm hoping to get across and what I'm hoping you will hold in your head is this sort of dichotomy of time scale. where here are events that have taken place over the last 200 years, or 1887, 140 years that get us here, but there's another story that goes much deeper into the past. So that's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday, I will do a PowerPoint presentation on the environmental investigations that have been done here, because I know about them, because I did a lot of them, or I did part of a lot of them. And then everybody goes away and has dinner on Thursday night and then comes back, and Paul Haynes, who is the Public Works Director here, has another talk, which is from now into the future. I'm going to talk about how we got to where we are today, last week, last month, recently, and what are the environmental problems associated with the mine, how are we planning on fixing them, and then he will take it from here forward as to how that will impact the village. And then Friday, we will take a hike over onto the other side of the creek and look at some of those things that are more related to the mine. It will be much more specific than the sort of general geology that we'll do when we go on hike 10 mile. My style of lecturing is a little different than Cliff's or Nancy's or Jim's, right? They're trying to draw you out and share personal stories that I don't care anything about. This touchy-feely stuff. But the other part is that it's really serious, right? There's two things more serious than your health, which are spirituality and poetry, and there's one thing more important than spirituality, which is poetry. So where science is on that, it's not even on the program. So I will save all that serious stuff for other times. And studying geology has been one of the most fortunate things that I've ever done in my life. And the reason that I studied geology was because I had a very engaging and enthusiastic and something geology professor. Because of that, so many beautiful and lovely and great and fun things have accrued to me. I don't know what to do. Sometimes I just laugh because I don't know how else to behave when I know how fortunate I've been about that. I don't think it's giving something back, but it's if one of you, either tonight or this week or in any of the years that I've done this, says, God, there must be something in that geology that's going to get that guy so ramped up. And you go and you take a geology trip and have some fun like I did, then that's the whole point here. So that, I don't know, maybe I could do a laid-back Jim Bodine thing, but I don't know if they have enough Ritalin for that. All right, I have handouts and props and jokes, and then there's like this much geology. The problem is I have 24 sets of handouts for us to look at, so if you're friends with somebody or could stay friends with somebody for the next hour, then if we work with them, and then if we need some more, we can pass them around. I'll make more copies. Some of these are in color, which is...
I'm friends with him.
But it's early. All right, let's talk about the concept of geologic time. As you get, I'll wait for just a second while you get these. Part of the handouts, the most schematic pieces of the handouts that come at the end, come out of this book called Roadside Geology of Washington by Alton Hinman. I find this and these, we got a couple of spares here, so who, somebody thinks they might get upset with the person they're sharing with? Really, I got a copy. these books, the Roadside Geology series, I find to be a very good series of books. They're available for 35 of the states. They're of a good level between cartoony simple and jargony geotalk. So this is something that with a little bit of work, if you are interested in geology, this is a good set of books. So that, and here's another book by Alton Hinman, same dudes. This covers more of the Northwest, not just Washington, but Washington, Oregon, Idaho, stuff like that. This one is older, and this one is newer. So they've done some reinterpreting based on this new stuff, but we're just going with the old version because that's what I made copies of. So that's one of the things about science is it's always changing, and we're always trying to figure out new things. All right, geologic time. I think this is the most important thing I'm going to share with you all week. So it's good that this is like we talked about early this morning, eating dessert first, right? This is, it might be the only important thing I talk about all week. So the Earth, as a scientist, my belief is the Earth is 4.56 billion years old. 4.56 billion years old. That's 4.5 times 10 to the 9th years. That's 4,560 million years. The Earth is very, 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 very old. That's 18 berries. That's the sliding Cobberly scale of how old the Earth is. So how do we conceive, on the one hand, today, in comparison to 4.56 billion years? You will know that I have fully integrated both of those time scales. Whenever that does happen, you will know it's happened to me because my head will explode. It's how do we do it? I mean, it's on. I find it, I've been thinking about it for since 1977 when I took my first geology class, so 31 years now, and it's how do we talk about when we talk about a million years in geologic scale is the blink of an eye. In human time scale, it's inconceivably long. I think there are things that accrue to us by thinking about how long the Earth has been here. We could maybe talk about those in some other sessions, or they might come up in someone's piece of literature. What I'm trying not to be hyperbolic here about one of the great intellectual achievements of humankind, directly as a result of studying geology, is the recognition of geologic time, the immensely long time scale over which geologic forces apply. Why do we think the Earth is 4.56 billion years old? Because the other stuff in our solar neighborhood, in our little corner of the universe, is that old. Moon rocks that have been brought back have been age dated at right around that age. And meteorites that impact the Earth have been found to be of that age as well. And the theory of the formation of the Earth is that the Earth started as a big cold dust ball. Big cold dust ball, I'm going to make sure I said that right, and rocks started to agglomerate together. Something that is big has more gravity. It started sucking in more rocks from the surrounding area of space as this ball began to orbit the sun. More and more comes in. Now there's enough gravity so that things start to impact the proto-Earth with some force. That continues for quite some time. Between that and the radioactive materials in the stuff that made the Earth up, there are two sources of heat there. Now we have an Earth that becomes molten and differentiates so that the core of the Earth is iron and nickel. At a very high temperature, it's just there's so much weight sitting on top of it that the molecule, the atoms can't move, so they're actually a solid. The oldest rocks that we have, what does it say on that sheet of paper? What are the oldest age-dated rocks that we have? Fourth, oh, the whole point of this is if we analogize the entire 4.56 billion years of Earth history into one 24-hour day, where do these things that we think we know about, where do they fall in that 24-hour day? So if we take midnight of whatever the day is as the formation of the Earth, where do these other things happen during the day? The oldest known rocks on the Earth are dated at 4.03 billion years old. So we have a little bit of a gap there between 4560 and 4030, or 4003, whatever that is, where we don't know. The expectation or the hypothesis is that the Earth was molten at that time, and so there are no rocks that were crystallizing until the Earth cooled that we could then age date. So there is a somewhat unknown time in Earth history. Next thing on our list is oldest potential life on Earth, 3,800 million years ago, or on our day about 4 a.m. So for the first, sixth of the Earth's lifespan, it was either too hot or too something for there to be any life at all. At 4 o'clock in the morning in our 24-hour day, we get some potential life on Earth. There is dispute in the scientific community about whether those things are actually representative of life or representative of organic molecules that might not have been alive. Those things are cyanobacteria, which are blue-green bacteria or blue-green algae. Those helped to produce enough oxygen so that at some point later in geologic time, there was sufficient oxygen for things that were oxygen breathers to develop and evolve. And for iron formations to form in the Earth, it's very clearly shown in Earth rock history where oxygen levels became somewhat like they are today. And that was the first environmental catastrophe in the history of the Earth, which is a little bit hard to think about. But if you were a cyanobacteria, or if you were some kind of bacteria that couldn't handle oxygen, the fact that the oxygen levels increased greatly and killed most of those things off, it seems a little, is that a paradox, Jim, that the first great environmental catastrophe on Earth was the fact that there was enough oxygen so that now we can come along and breathe it? Oh, anyway, that happens. Significant free oxygen in the atmosphere for the first time. 2,200 million years ago, or just after noon in our 24-hour day. So for the first half of the life of the planet, there wasn't sufficient oxygen for anything of any great magnitude to have developed that needed oxygen to survive. So we're already past noon, and nothing is out there except for these bacteria. By the time we get to Paleolithic, does anybody know about the major ages of the Earth, the Paleozoic, the Cenozoic, and the Mesozoic?
I've heard of them.
Okay. Well, these are, in geologic time, these are the major age differentiations of the Earth, the Paleozoic era, the Mesozoic, and the Cenozoic, which is the most recent. And this is where we spend most of our time talking about geology. And yet the start of the Paleozoic, I have on my list here at 543 million years ago, is at 9 o'clock at night. So the first first 7/8, right? 9 o'clock at night is 7/8 into the day. The first 7/8 of our day has gone by, and not much has happened, and we don't know very much about it as far as anything alive happening. The Earth has gone through a number of changes. It was molten to start. It started to solidify. In the earliest days, the atmosphere was non-existent, and then there were gases involved that were not oxygen. The atmosphere gets to a point where there's enough oxygen for critters to evolve. And so at the start of Paleozoic time, we have what's called in geology the Cambrian explosion. This is the first time in geologic history that we have, that we find in the fossil record anything that we kind of, what a layperson would think of as a fossil. Before that, what we see are microscopic etchings of things that look like they're shaped like stuff that we see now that is alive. Or algal mats, which when you see them are just sort of, if you take a tussock of grass or a tuft of grass and put some mud in it, that's kind of what the fossil looks like for this cyanobacteria. And so 543 million years ago, a very long time ago on human scale, 7/8 of the way through the day on the geologic time scale, we start to get things like trilobites and crabs, horseshoe-type crab. The trilobite is sort of a big bug or beetle-looking thing, and or half-beetle, half-crab-looking thing, but it's the first time that there is some sort of skeleton or some sort of shell that we can actually see found in the fossil record. So we're 7/8 of the way through the day before anything of any great interest starts to happen.
Excuse me, can we ask questions?
Absolutely.
Were there any plant fossils at that time?
No. Okay. No, because there are certainly no plant fossils before there's oxygen, because the plants needed the oxygen to live. Yeah, there at.
When you have fossil records, it's like sea creatures and plants, or
I'm thinking more about the animal kingdom rather than plants. So yeah, there would have been, not too long after there was free oxygen in the atmosphere, that's when cyanobacteria don't need oxygen. Oxygen becomes available in the atmosphere, and now we start to get low plants that over time evolve into sort of flowering plants and plants that create seeds. So, because, and part of that is they needed things to co-evolve with them to spread the seeds around. So, where are we at here?
9 o'clock at night.
9 o'clock at night. I have on my list here at 10:26 the estimate of time of formation of the Holden ore body. Let's leave that aside for the moment. At 10:28 we have the start of the Mesozoic time period, the age of the dinosaurs. So we're at 10:30 at night before we get any dinosaurs. So we're fairly late in the day before that happens. At that time there was one, what we call supercontinent. As we talk about plate tectonics in a moment, we'll start to get the idea that the continents as we see them today, this is a snapshot in time that we think is permanent, that over geologic time has been incredibly impermanent. We have at least two good indications that back in geologic time, all of the continents that we currently identify as being separate have been all mashed together at one point on the planet. So at least twice before, we're in one of the spread out phases. I don't know, maybe a geologic term for that, but I don't know what it is. But if we go back to 250 million years ago, essentially everything that we think of as continental landmass right now was all mashed together as one big continent. Go back to between 250 and 600 million years ago, again, we were in a spread out phase. 600 million years ago, we had a whole bunch of continents all mashed together again. So what we think of as being, this is the map, and this is the way the map has always been, well, yeah, in human time, that's the case. In geologic time, that's not the case at all. So 250 million years ago, 245 million years ago, is the start of the age of dinosaurs. oldest dinosaur fossils are 220 million years, something like that. So again, we're after 10:30 at night in our 24-hour day. At 110 million years ago, what I have on our table, which is equivalent to 11:11 in the evening, the west coast of North America, what we now think of as North America, was somewhere back, this way is going north, somewhere back there, right? The Idaho-Washington border is back that way. So if we had been doing Holden Elder Village 110 million years ago at the Holden site, we'd be bobbing in the water, speaking to one another, and the sessions wouldn't last as long because we couldn't dog paddle for an hour at a time. We'd have to, I don't know. But anyway, where we're standing and sitting right now was out in the ocean at that point. Everybody okay with that? Okay, how that happens, we'll start to talk about in a little bit. At 65 million years ago, what happened 65 million years ago, Gay?
Huh?
What happened 65 million years ago?
65 million years ago. What time is it again?
It's 60. I don't know. What time is it, Cliff, at 65 million years ago?
It's 11:40 p.m., Gay.
65 million years ago was when the big meteorite hit.
Oh, the dinosaurs disappeared.
And the dinosaurs disappeared. That's a date, is that a geologic date? That how many people knew that ahead of time? And don't you can even if it makes Gay feel bad that you knew that.
Never put the hands up.
Say that again, Karen.
I remembered it after Gay.
After I reminded you.
Okay, at 65 million years ago, we have this event, soon after 65 million years ago, we find no more dinosaurs. The dinosaurs ruled the planet from 220 million years ago to 65 million years ago, 155 million years. That's a long time. That extinction of the dinosaurs, to me, is a very interesting study of science and how it progresses, because 30 years ago, we had no idea about why that happened. At some time around there, the hypothesis was proposed that a big meteorite impact had hit the Earth and had caused some global catastrophe that had wiped out the dinosaurs. The evidence for that, the key bit of evidence for that is a mineral, iridium, which is very rarely found on Earth, is only found in relation to meteorite impacts, and it was found very widely spread throughout the geologic column in a number of places throughout the world. So that became the in vogue theory, and now as time has gone on over the last 25 years, there is some thinking that what has happened was there were a number of not worldwide but close to worldwide insults that happened before that, and that was the final nail in the coffin for the dinosaurs, but they were well on their way out before the meteorite hit. One of the things that is part of that, one of the things that was pushing the dinosaurs out of the way beforehand was there in India, there was a basalt eruption very similar to what we have here in the Columbia Plateau, the Columbia basalts. So here is volcanic eruptions of sort of a Hawaiian island type at some scale that none of us can imagine because it's thousands of times bigger than anything we've ever seen. Gas was emitted along with the volcanic material. The hypothesis is that there was global climate change ongoing for some period of time before that, and that, again, the meteorite impact was the last nail in the coffin. 65 million years ago, which we think of as being quite a long time ago, that's 20 minutes to midnight, right? Is that what the clock says? The next line, 45 million years ago, 11:46 p.m., North Cascades microcontinent, including the Holden ore body, docks to the western North America. We'll get back to that in just a minute. The last three lines of time relate more to us rather than sort of geologic events. They talk about human or pre-human scale events. And so it was about 2 million years ago that the Homo genus that we belong to diverged from the Australopithecines, which were another variant of pre-human that we diverged from, and then went about our merry way to 0.4 million years ago, 400,000 years ago, which is archaic Homo sapiens evolved, which are things that are more like us. And all of this thing has all of those things happened in the last minute of the day. The last line, when we talked this morning, when Nancy talked this morning about these ancient practices that we think of as being extremely old.
Okay. I get it.
This is where the human time scale and the geologic time scale get schizophrenic. We think when we that, as long as my math is correct, which there's some, I'm confident that that's the case. If you want, the whole point here is that if we take 4.56 billion years and make it into 24-hour day, that's 1,440 minutes, you do the math, and it's 3.2 million years per minute. If you try to get 5,000 years into 3.2 million, it turns out to be about a tenth of a second. So what we think of as being permanent and ancient and something, the planet thinks of as having been in the last tenth of a second of a 24-hour day. So if you don't like my comment about the Earth being very, 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 very 18 times old, you could just look at it differently and say that we are very, 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 very late to the party. I had a couple of things up at the top of the page there that I liked very well. James Hutton, who was the father of modern geology, used a line to describe the vast amount of time with the comment, "We find no vestige of a beginning and no prospect of an end." And those are fairly famous words in geology, but they are very evocative to me, and maybe that sort of to some degree disqualifies me as a scientist, but I just find when I read those words, I hear them spoken by James Earl Jones. Right? Is that who I'm thinking of? The very deep voice. Mm-hmm. And so I just, that whole concept of no vestige of a beginning and no prospect of an end. Another term that I like very well that helps, again, I see these things as trying to help me and maybe trying to help you get some essence, get some getting, falling into this idea of geologic time. The Earth is tremendously old. I'll try one other analogy with you about that. And maybe this will work better, maybe it'll work worse. Maybe it'll work exactly the same. If those of you who are 50 and a little bit think of a 50-year time span, is that something you can grasp? Okay, if you think of the width of this piece of paper as a 50-year time span, this hundredth of an inch or whatever it happens to be, that's 50 years. And now if you're like really old, maybe you could remember two thicknesses of paper, and now you can remember 100 years of time span. To imagine the time span of the Earth, you would have to have this stack of paper be 5.8 miles long.
From here past Heart Lake.
Okay. Is the point made, I guess. If you walk out the front door here and you look down to the stop sign by the right here by the schoolyard, using this theory and taking 50-year slices per piece of paper, you could look back 34 million years. So what do we even have on our list of interesting things that ever happened in the last 34 million years? It's all about us, of course. Nothing geologically interesting has happened over that entire time. That's not true, but that this 24-hour clock idea is one that I see commonly presented in sort of geologic texts, and sometimes I get it and sometimes I don't, but this whole idea of slices of time is one that appeals more to me, so if it's useful to you, then that was a good minute and a half we just spent. Are there any questions at this point? Yes.
My name is John, and I'm kind of an open-minded guy, and I'm just wondering, does God fit in here anywhere?
Does God fit in here anywhere?
Yeah.
How?
Genesis, creation, age of the world, the Psalms, our devotions, our worship.
I can tell you one very personal opinion about that. Okay? Which is mine. Which is, I believe that the world is the way we have figured it out to be. That the Earth is 4.56 billion years old. That's the truth. That's the reality that we are confronted with, that I am confronted with. For me personally, and I hate that phrasing, my perspective is that my understanding of this, whatever this is, this dance that we're doing, this time that we're on the stage, is not dependent on the fact that a creation story does not match up. This is still a world of spirit. It's a world of spirit that's 4.6 billion years old. The fact that for some other people, if it's not 6,000 years old, it doesn't make any sense at all. I don't get that. We have plenty of opportunities to sit around and do table talk on this, and whether Nancy would touch on this or whether Jim would touch on this, those two things are disconnected to me. My job, my life as a rational person, my life as a puzzle solver, which is what I do, is dependent on interacting with the world the way it really is, not the way I would hope it to be, or not the way a sacred text has told me it is. But that's how I've gotten here, is by looking at the evidence and using rationality and I'm stumbling a little bit, but the world is the Earth is as old as it is. And please.
I disagree that it's not connected, because that's one of the questions why I asked the question about the fossil, was if it included plant and certain animals, is because
another scientist, it's totally integrated for me in that I can accept that there's perhaps even a third time scale, which is God's time scale. And the Bible says that what man knows can be nothing more than a blink of an eye to God. So we can have a time scale incredibly longer than even the number of years it took to create the earth. And it would still be within the concept of God's creation. Does that make sense to you? Because it didn't really start with the world forming. It started with the creation of the dust. The dust created from somewhere. Out there somewhere, there's a big bang. Is that the creation of God? To me, it could be. I can identify with even a huger distance of time than just, what, a bunch of 4.5 million years?
Billion.
I think the bang was much earlier than that, but the earth may not have been created then.
No.
I would like to hear you tell me that again while we're having a cup of coffee.
Okay, I love that.
Okay, I don't have an answer to that. I have one answer to that, and that's the answer for me. And I don't, I can both follow what I believe to be the science of the issue that arrives at the age that it arrives at and still believe that this is a world of spirit. Those two things are not, what's the opposite of complementary? Mutually exclusive. I don't need to pick one of those two. I don't need to pick one of those two.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm open-minded. I want to hear what you have to say, but I heard no reference to God and creation, and I surely don't know the year span, and I don't really get hung up on that. But when you start taking God completely out of the picture, I get a little nervous. That's all. I'm here to listen.
Okay.
I raised a similar question. I was at the University of Washington taking geology as a minor and raised a similar question when a professor said, was talking about the sequence of development and said, you know, we can't go from this link to this link. We have no record. And this was a few years ago. However, I have never read that they have found the links from this point to this point. It's like, we don't know. All of a sudden, you know, we have the evolution of a species that isn't related directly to the one in front of it. And he said, those are the missing links. And I went up after a lecture and said to him, could that be accounted for in Genesis? And he smiled at me and he said, most certainly. This was from the University of Washington, and it's always given me great solace that this gels. This is what Scripture says. And the only thing we have to say is you know, a day isn't a day, or a day is longer than a day, or whatever. But so it was very clear in my mind.
Okay.
And he called it the missing links.
Okay.
We also have different areas in which we operate. And I remember hearing an East Indian physicist speak. And he was a worshiper of Krishna. And that is, I mean, if anybody finds anything in biblical scripture strange, some of this East Indian beliefs defy description in comparison, and yet he had no conflict in being a physicist and a respected physicist and a worshiper of Lord Krishna because even though Krishna affected how he conducted his daily life, these were two different fields of endeavors. And a lot of people don't see truth as an either-or proposition like we Westerners do. And even in the Old Testament and in Jewish study, there is an embracing of paradox. And we are most uncomfortable with having one thing that seems to be true in contradiction with another thing that seems to be true. We really have a hard time with that, and other cultures don't. Not all other cultures don't. There's some other cultures that would too. But that is a particular way of our thought that we really have a hard time embracing paradox.
Okay. All right. I was thinking, I don't know whether my response to your question was that I don't have trouble embracing paradox, or whether I don't know, I have to think about that. Say again?
You don't see a paradox.
I don't see a paradox. So yes, I don't have any trouble embracing a paradox I don't see.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, I'm two things. I would love to further that particular discussion, and I would love to pursue that further discussion at the Holden, sometime up in the dining hall. Let's all right. We talked about geologic time. The other basic geologic thing I would like to talk about that will help herd us towards why we're here is the concept of plate tectonics, which is the unifying model of geology, which is a theory that has come into being since I started studying geology back in 1977. Before that, there were a number of geologic processes that even in the scientific paper, you'd get to a certain point and it says, and then something happened and this is not well understood. I don't know if other lines of scientific inquiry had that common phraseology of not well understood, but that was in geology. And then due to a number of scientific advances, the hypothesis or the theory of plate tectonics came forward. And plate tectonics can be summed up in about four things. One, the surface of the Earth that we think of as being stable and solid is made up of about 20 to 25 fairly brittle plates. These move around on the underlying mantle, which is stout but still deformable. The motivating force behind plate tectonics is the fact that there is a huge light bulb at the center of the Earth, and that's not true. There's not a big light bulb at the center of the Earth, but a lava lamp is a very good model for the driving mechanism of plate tectonics, which is the Earth is hot in the middle and it's cold at the outside. The Earth is shedding heat from the middle to the outside, and where this is okay in sort of one dimension, in reality what there is are big convection currents of heat through the mantle that work as big conveyor belts to push these brittle plates around on the deformable, flowy stuff that's underneath them. Brittle plates, soft, stout but deformable stuff underneath it, convection of heat from the center or the middle of the Earth being the driving mechanism, And the rate at which this happens is about the rate at which your fingernail grows. So the plates are moving, those that are moving at about that rate, which is not very much. But if you've grown a fingernail for a million years, that's a fairly long finger. They probably get unwieldy at some point. So that at some point in the geologic future, if things continue to go the way they have recently, Los Angeles will be north of San Francisco, because Los Angeles is on the west side of the San Andreas Fault. The San Andreas Fault is moving at that fingernail growth pace. But given it, we could, if we wanted to, we could look up the math, or we could do the math and figure out about what year LA and San Francisco will be co-sister cities as LA continues further north. So, plates are brittle. They move around on stuff that flows. Shedding of heat from the center of the Earth to the fringes, and a rate of about fingernail growth, 1 or 2 millimeters per year. The handouts that you have behind the table that we talked through, the first one is a couple of pages that are taken from a book called Earth Story, which I think is a very good book. And there was a 5-part BBC series that came along with the book. This is a 1998-ish. And if you ever see them, if you ever see that listed on television, that is an excellent series to watch. Behind that are a number of handouts from that book that I pointed out from Alt and Hinman. And we can talk, I think what we can do is talk more about the specifics of this. We should defer that talk until tomorrow, because we have 5 minutes left in the session. And I want to give you my understanding or my interpretation of how the Holden Mine got here. We will arm wave it tonight, and then we will talk about it again and in a little more depth tomorrow. The ore, the method of emplacement of the ore that we find up in the mountain is called an exhalative. Interesting that that word should show up. Ore body.
Exhalative.
Exhalative. What happens, the ore, the gold, copper, zinc, and silver, that were the main metals that were extracted, we believe were exhaled through black smoker type vents, which are how many people are not familiar with that terminology, a black smoker? Okay. In the ocean, what we have found and videoed are these vents where superheated water, 800 or 1,000 degrees centigrade water, is exhaled. Pooped out is the word I like to use, but some people find... What's another... what's a technical word for...
Excreted.
Nah, I don't like those better than I...
vomiting.
Water comes out of a vent.
Spewed
out. Perfect. And because that water is superheated, it has the ability to carry metals at a higher concentration than normal water does. The heating keeps things in solution. That water is spewed out, comes in contact with ocean water, which is colder and has more oxygen in it, and the metals flocculate out. They sort of flake out and thread out and make boogers. I wish that wasn't on tape. I don't know. That's my... Well, but it's not, I think of it
become
as being
solid?
A little bit, it's partly solid, partly liquid, partly flaky, partly slimy stuff that would come out, and because it was heavier than water, would settle out. That material, the gold, copper, zinc, and lead, iron, and sulfur, were being... flaked out into a mud, a low-lying, flat-lying mud area that we think happens on the side of volcanoes that were being built during that time period. A volcano would erupt. The volcano would then be eroded. Here's the water. The volcano is built up through eruption. The volcano erodes based on rainfall. The mud gets shed off into these low-lying seas. And so there are layers upon layers upon layers of mud. And somewhere in that area were these small... You can think of these vents, these black smokers, as being sort of very miniature volcanoes. They're connected to probably the same heat source or some heat source down deep. And now the black smoker is spewing out this material that flocculates and solidifies and dumps, falls under gravity into the mud. And so now there is this mixture of material coming off the volcanoes that incorporates that gold, copper, zinc, and silver. So now we find it in that mud. If we had been in this area, which is somewhere to the west of us, 250 million years ago, where there is some volcano from some island arc, sort of like Indonesia is today, we see the volcanoes, we don't see these. The mud's being shed off, the material gets put into the mud, and it sits there for 150 million years. Over this time, as this big supercontinent is breaking up, the sense of direct, now the western part of what we now call North America, at 110 million years ago, is somewhere over in Idaho, Montana. This continental plate is moving west, and whatever happens to be in the way is just sort of getting mashed on to the side of the continent. So everything that we're, all of Washington are these little bits and pieces of Indonesia size or Japan size or, excuse me, not as big as Australia. These bits and pieces of islands that have just gotten smashed onto the continent as the continent has been moving west. Somewhere between 100 million years ago and 50 million years ago, the bit of the world that started as this volcanic island like Indonesia gets mashed onto, here comes North America as this big plate. This is moving this way. This is moving this way. Things get smashed up, and so this mud with the ore in it gets compressed. First it gets lithified. First it gets turned into rock. It goes from mud to being what we call a mudstone. Second, it gets metamorphosed because it gets compressed. It gets put under pressure both from weight on top of it plus these two things smashing it together. And what we see in the mind is that these layers that were originally laid down horizontally are now laid in this orientation with the ore in a fairly thin band in spatial, 300 to 600 feet thick is the ore, was the Holden ore body. So when we, if we look at it up on the mountain, we see this fairly narrow layer in rock that we can identify as back in geologic time having been mud that was shed off some sort of volcano. So the mine is here because of this chain of geologic events that goes back. This event right here, the spewing, we think is about 250 million years old. This event, the smashing on of the Island Arc onto sort of central western Washington that then made Washington much bigger, even though it was 110 million years ago and Washington wasn't very old then. That happened about 110 million years ago, and it was in that sort of things being compressed together that those layers got changed into the rock that they are now and put into the orientation, excuse me, that they are now. And sat there for 100 million years until 1887 when Holden fell. Are there any questions?
No, that's very clear. Thank you. I didn't understand it before, but now I get it.
Okay. Then you can go. Anybody who has questions has to stay. No, please go ahead.
Where did the zinc, lead, and gold, and copper originally come from? Were they free-standing elements? Or did they form, were they part of the mantle?
They would have come from the mantle because that's where these black smokers, they would have come from deeper down in the crust material, and the hot water would have acted very similar to a solvent and would have preferentially eaten those things or concentrated them. And then again, it's as that material changed, the superheated water, superheated and low oxygen water gets spewed out into cooler and more oxygen-rich water. That's what causes that material to flocculate out.
Was your question, was it gold when it was down here?
Yeah, were they freestanding elements at that point?
Was it gold before?
I expect it was, and then it got associated with sulfur, which is what all of the, when you look at the actual geologic mineralogy of those, up on the mountain, they didn't find pure AU, or they did find a little pure AU, gold, sorry, but the zinc was mixed with sulfur, the copper, it was CUS, copper sulfide. Chalcopyrite. So, we have 10 minutes to make it to Vespers. So those of you who want to go now should do that. Those who want to stay and have questions answered, please come.